Everything that you wanted, I have done. You asked that the child be taken. I took him. You cowered before me. I was frightening. I have reordered time. I have turned the world upside down. And I have done it all for you. I am exhausted from living up to your expectations.
Greetings and well met, travelers. You have found your way to Dragonreel, a magical journey to the realm of fantasy movies.
Welcome back to the Dragonreel podcast. This is episode 19, Labyrinth. Fear me, love me, do as I say, and I will be your podcast host. I'm Chris. And in chair number two, she reminds me of the babe.
What babe?
What do you mean, what babe?
The babe with the power.
What?
What power? The power of voodoo.
What are you talking about?
Voodoo? You do.
Are you insane?
Do what? Remind me of the babe.
Whatever you're talking about, it's Sharon!
Oh my gosh, everyone knows what I'm talking about!
And in chair number three tonight, for the first time ever, fresh from his gig across town at the Tome Show podcast, it's so stimulating being his hat, it's James Intercasso!
It's so stimulating being worn, so... Happy to be here.
In chair number four, her will is as strong as yours and her kingdom is as great. It's Bonnie McDonald.
Hello.
Good to have you two with us for the first time ever. And your timing is great because unfortunately Pete was unable to make it to this recording. So we will soldier on without him and hopefully Pete will be back with us as soon as he can be.
Oh, I hope he's not in the bog of everlasting stench.
Eternal stench, you mean.
Oh, eternal stench. Because... that would really stink.
Is this how it's going to be?
I hope so.
Okay, so we are going to talk about the 1986 David Bowie star vehicle Labyrinth, which was also a Jim Henson production and directed by Jim Henson.
I know we're not supposed to say it at the beginning, but... I love this movie!
I think we can go ahead and get that out of the way. This has been one of my favorite movies forever. How about you guys?
Yeah, I mean, ever since I was a child, certainly, I think that this has been a movie that has been watched over and over again.
Oh, definitely. In my house as well. It's all fantasy and all sci-fi, and this was a big part of growing up.
And I think if you ranked all the movies by the number of times I've seen them, Labyrinth is probably in my top three.
Wow.
And every single time I see it, I find something new to think about.
Me too.
So I'm going to ask you guys, starting with Bonnie, what was your first experience finding this film?
So 1986 would probably have made me getting close to 2 years old. So Labyrinth probably would have come out, you know, on VHS at some point or had been on cable. And then it was something that, like, I can't remember the first time I actually sat and watched it. It was just one of those movies that was on all the time. Like, it would be, oh, it's going to come on tonight. And the, you know, the special movie Saturday night, and, you know, mom would make popcorn and we would all gather around to do it. We did that with lots of fantasy movies. Wow. So that was that was my first experience, was being super young and it just being a part of my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Amazing.
Very similar. So Bonnie and I are both youngest children. Mm-hmm. And we're the same age. So my experience too is I was probably very young and my brother and sister wanted to watch it and I was there too, mm-hmm. would be my guess. Mm-hmm. I know I grew up in a house similar to Bonnie, very big on sci-fi and fantasy and very big to just Muppets in general.
Yep.
You know, and I think because this had the Henson branding, but it was one of the things that my parents felt comfortable, like,
we'll
put this on and we'll leave you alone with it, even though,
that's,
you know,
a great point.
yeah so like it has that, it was made for children, so you can let the movie babysit the children thing going
or
for it.
Can you?
Or can you? Yes, that's a very good question.
This is really a great point, because oftentimes when we're doing the podcast, we've discussed what would children think of it? And we're a little bit older than you guys. I won't say how much, but it's it's very interesting for me to get a different age point of view on this, because I really didn't watch Labyrinth until I was in high school. Mm-hmm. So I was already high school age when it came out. So you guys always knew of it and kind of grew up with it, and it was just part of your world. And so it's really neat to get that perspective, and to get the perspective of, was it an interesting movie for kids? I think I used to play this movie when I worked in daycare for little kids, and they
interesting.
They
grew up confused.
Yeah, they liked it. But when you guys were 10, you liked this movie, I guess.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. When I'm 30, almost 32, I like this movie. I was okay. So delighted when you said that this was the movie we were gonna watch, because I was excited to. I can't remember the last time I watched it, so I was excited to look at it with discerning adult eyes. And that felt that like a lot of the ways that I felt about it when I was younger were similar to the way I feel about it now.
Right. Do you remember the last time before this that you watched it?
I really can't. I can tell you when I saw The Dark Crystal last, but not when I saw Labyrinth. Wow.
Sharon, what about you? Do you remember first seeing it?
I believe it was high school. I remember seeing it again in college, and when I started playing D&D and really diving deep into fantasy, and just in college, I think that probably like the second, third, fourth, fifth, and tenth time I saw it in college, we would watch it a lot with different people, and somebody would say, oh, I've never seen Labyrinth, or, I would say, oh, it's so unfair, but that's the way it is, and then somebody would say, well, what do you mean by that, and I would look back at them and say, haven't you seen Labyrinth, and they're like, Labyrinth, what's that, or She Chose Down. I mean, there are so many great lines from this, right. And then just getting that new person and bringing them in, and I love doing that. I don't know what it is about my personality, but I love exposing people. This sounds wrong. I don't want to stay on this train, but I mean, like, introducing people to new things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Like new movies or new games, stuff like that. So it's just really fun when somebody has not seen something that you love, and just introducing it to them for the first time. I love doing that.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember about the time period that it came out, but I didn't see it in theater. And I know that because I remember the Marvel Comics adaptation coming out. And I remember just deciding between that and New Mutants issue number 8 or so, and I took the superheroes, and I went, I really wish I'd read Labyrinth. And so it wasn't long after it came out on VHS that I finally got to see it. And it was, it was pretty cool, and I thought that was pretty amazing, and I thought, wait a minute, maybe that's about something deeper than just going through a labyrinth. And then, all these other ideas came percolating through my head.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it definitely, when you're a little kid, it seems like an awesome adventure movie. And watching it again as an adult, especially watching it for this podcast, was definitely the first time I had watched it since David Bowie had passed away.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I think even that adds a whole other layer to it, you know?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Definitely.
I think so, too. And I think he was amazing in it. I think every time he's on screen, you're just sort of spellbound. And everything he says is just this magical minute of, oh.
Well, it's all, everything he says is so significant.
Yes.
To what is happening to her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How she's going from this absolutely self-absorbed, whiny child,
narcissistic
teenager.
Yeah, everything's about me.
To growing up and realizing that there's more people in the world that matter than her.
Well, and stuff.
Yeah, and her
because,
stuff.
I mean, she's really in the beginning all about her things. Someone's been in my room again.
Your father and I go out very rarely.
I go out every single weekend.
And I ask you to babysit only if it won't interfere with your plans.
Well, how do you know? You don't know what my plans are. You don't even ask me anymore.
Well, I assume you'd tell me if you had a date.
So anyway, so she's a whiny little kid.
She does strike me, I remember watching the beginning of the movie, and I was like, this girl is horrible. Like, that was actually really hard for me. And obviously, I love the movie, you know, from all the memories of my childhood, so I was still going to go along with her anyway. But I was like, you are not doing me any favors in latching onto her as my, you know, as my heroine to root for. I was like, terrible babysitter. Just like, stop yelling at this baby who's crying.
Oh my God, I felt so bad when she's yelling right in the baby's face.
I know!
She's just like, you want a story? You want a story? Fine, I'll tell you a story. You know, I think that's the moment when I started really paying attention to the movie, sort of when she starts that and then you see the goblins. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, she says, you know, Goblin King, take this child far away from me. And like, that's not the words.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Say it.
Say it. And
yeah, it's funny because it is. It could be that scene, and this is. I feel like this is true in a lot of the movie. That scene could be very dark if there wasn't the comedic relief of that goblin saying,
right, it was very tense,
Absolutely, because it, you know, kind of like, you know, when you play D&D, opening that portal, that's the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the total magic happens, and we're not in the real world anymore. We are in two different places, and one is clearly a very, you know, different world.
Right.
And then sort of it's almost anticlimactic when she says,
I wish the goblins would come and take you away. Right now.
But you already know from seeing the goblin puppetry that is the words that she's supposed
to
say. So you were waiting for that. That's your catharsis right there.
But it's so moving because she says it just so calmly. And it's not with that big, you know, overdramatic voice that she uses and lifts the baby up in the other scene where the lightning flashes. She just turns off the light. And when she goes back and she finds, oh my God, he's not there. And then that's her moment. So we've already had the moment when we realize, oh, this is magical. This is another world. This is a portal. And then you get to watch her realize it. Oh my God, everything that I've been playing with, it's real.
Right.
But is it? Is it real?
Oh, that's a good question. I hadn't really thought about that, honestly. I just always assumed that it was real, but that's a great question.
Because everything that she encounters in the labyrinth is in her room at the beginning of the movie.
True. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's, and we were saying after we watched it that it does have, it's almost like an updated version of A Christmas Carol, in a sense, that like a character has this bizarre otherworldly experience and then learns to care about other people through it.
Right. That's a really great parallel. I
never thought of
that.
As you were talking, James, I was going to say The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But
that's one of the books that's on her shelf, too.
Oh, The Wizard of Oz is on her shelf?
Yeah, The Wizard of Oz is on her shelf, and Through the Looking Glass, Alice in Wonderland. So it has, elements of both of those. I hadn't even thought about A Christmas Carol. But that one, too.
I didn't either. So, wow. James, you've brought a whole nother level of introspectiveness.
You know, that's what I do. We're working. I bring the next level to Jim Henson movies.
I love that. I love that. But I guess all right, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to answer your question, Chris.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to leave it open. I think it is real, because unlike The Wizard of Oz, the characters move from the other world or dimension or portal to the real world. Because remember at the end where she says, if you need us, and she says, but sometimes I do need you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But I think that's her realizing that, okay, I've put these childish things behind me, but they're still there for me to take out and cherish. And I think that's kind of what that ending was. Mm. I think, you know, it wasn't a dream and it wasn't a reality. It was a metaphor for her coming to this realization. And, you know, a real teenager is not going to come to this realization in the space of, you know, 90 minutes.
Right. Right.
You know, a real teenager has to be confronted with, you know, actual evidence that nobody really cares about their special personhood.
Wait, but in the movie, I think, in the scope of this magical world, how many hours does Jared put on the clock?
13. But then he takes some of them away.
But, see, so that's my argument for why it's real. Because when you go through an experience like she went through, and you see her slowly changing throughout the adventures, you know, her friendship with, I want to get the name right because, okay, Hoggle, because nobody,
yes, that's right.
Nobody could get his name right through the whole movie. And, you know, so I said to Chris, I'm not very good with names, and I said, I know I'm going to call him Hogwart because I think Jared.
Jareth.
Oh, sorry. So you're saying you don't think it's real. I'm going to vote for it is real, but it's definitely a movie about a girl sort of becoming a young lady.
James, Bonnie, what do you think? Did it happen?
I want it to happen, so yes. I think it's much more magical that way.
Yeah, it's funny, I think, I've always interpreted it as it didn't happen, and then when everybody enters her room at the end, you're like, oh great, it did actually happen. Right. You know, that it was almost like a rug pull. I think, for me, I feel like Jim Henson would have been a little more obvious if he didn't want us to think it would have happened. She would have had also on her shelf at the beginning a David Bowie record, and that would be why she sees the Goblin King as David Bowie in her mind.
Here's the thing. If you look on her desk, there's something that looks like Jareth.
Oh.
Yes, there is.
There's like a little action figure type thing that's about a foot tall. There are photographs on her mirror that are the character's mother with some director person, and that person is David Bowie.
Is it?
It is.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Oh, wow.
Well, yeah, then, like I said, this is one of the things I've seen more times than anything.
Oh, you changed. Oh, you got James onto your side, Chris.
No,
I still think it is that. In my mind, she goes there. I think because I want her to have gone there. But then also because you do see the goblins creeping around, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I feel like we really need to address the elephant in the room since we're talking about David Bowie, which is David Bowie's penis throughout this movie in a starring role.
It was definitely top billing.
Yeah, because it's funny when I told James that I feel like this movie was almost like, this is gonna sound very strange, but like a sexual awakening for me, not in the way that like I was feeling any feelings, but it was that I was like, that is a penis, and I understand that is a penis now. Like, that is a place that I went that I could never come back from at that point.
I don't think that's awkward at all, because if ever I'm feeling entirely too heterosexual, I just put this movie on, and yeah, it shows me my place.
I can remember. So I watched this movie a lot as a young child, never noticed that. And then I watched it again in middle school. Like, it had been a few years, was hanging out with some friends, all dudes, and we're like, oh, Labyrinth, let's pop that in. And then, I can still remember the phrase we kept using was breakfast log. To describe the Bowie bulge, if you will. Also, I know it's cool to talk about this on the podcast, right? Like, you're not going to have to edit all this out later.
Do we have children that are fans? I don't know.
Depends what you mean by children.
Well, now it's their sexual awakening, too.
And I also think part of that is, you know, that also exists for Sarah because, you know, Bowie is sexy in this movie. And, a 15-year-old girl is going to have sexy guys on her mind.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And if we think they don't, we're lying to ourselves. If I was a 15-year-old girl once upon a time, and I thought about sexy guys. And I sort of remember watching The Thornbirds with my mother. I hate to admit that, but Richard Chamberlain. And getting back to David Bowie. Yeah, I mean, David Bowie what was he, 40 when he did this role? But but he's sort of timeless. He's sort of timeless in the costume and with the hair and with the makeup. And I saw this movie when I was a sighted person. And, you know, I can still, even though I'm blind now, I can still see him. I mean, the images are still in my head. I guess it's one of those images you can't get out of your head, no matter.
No. And it's so funny, too, because when we told some people that we were going to be doing this podcast about Labyrinth, that was the very first thing they said. They were like, oh, and you're going to talk about David Bowie's enormous bulge in the entire time? Yes, yes, I'm sure that we will. And it's funny, too, that James said about the fact that because it's Jim Henson, that is the reason that your parents would just, our parents would just be like, oh, okay, you can watch that. That's fine. And I think that if my mother had actually sat down and watched the whole thing, she would have been like, I don't know about this. And there's a really interesting moment, too, in like the, I don't know, the last third of the movie where like she's having a hallucination that he brings on her. And yeah, and there seems like there's all this like sexual tension between the two of us. And that made me feel slightly uncomfortable because she is 15. Right. And you're like, wait, what is his role to her? Like, what's happening?
But that was something that she said in the beginning. She said, but unknown to the evil stepmother, the Goblin King had fallen in love with her. And that was part of the story. That was part of what was going on. He was in love with her.
And he said, I've changed the world for you.
I am exhausted from living up to your expectations.
Because she wanted him to be evil and dark, but yet in love with her and willing to do her this favor. Well, whatever she asked for, and when she said, you know, take the child, and then she said, oh, I changed my mind. Nope, I really want my brother back. And at the dance, like, I think he keeps trying, like, with the gifts and everything, he keeps trying to distract her, like, no, you don't want your brother. You know, you want beautiful balls, and even... Wait, no, I didn't even think what I was saying. I meant dances, like, you know, where there's... Okay, I just went to
We
a
had
Jane...
been talking about that already, Sharon.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry, Jane Austen convention, so I really mean like a ball where there's, you know, masquerade and...
Right,
and...
but the things that he's offering her are, in my opinion, things that keep her a child. She wants the romantic fantasy of the masquerade ball where it's just, you know, it's like the faceless dream where it's all just pretend and the dancing is what's really the romance that's going on.
And the looking, the eye contact, but mm-hmm. There's no kissing at all in this movie, but it's still a sexy movie. Mm. I mean, wouldn't you guys say that?
Right, yeah. I don't think you would put David Bowie in a movie, especially in 1986, if you didn't want to have some sort of sex appeal. You know, he's a very, especially at that time, was a very sexual person. And I actually, so this is going to be a side delve real quick, but my uncle... was his production manager for his touring concerts for a long time. And he has all these stories about Bowie was actually obsessed with phalluses and had, like, on stage would have giant inflatable phalluses and stuff. So the fact that he is dressed the way he is and is so sexual, I feel like they had to want that to be a component of the movie. Or they were very naive when they hired David Bowie, you know?
That's the way it always...
Like, he dressed from his own wardrobe?
Oh, he might have. And that's the way it always strikes me, is that, like... Almost as if Jim Henson was naive when they cast David Bowie, or it's because I grew up with it as a children's movie that I didn't really, I always thought it was like sort of a weird and inappropriate movie for children. Maybe it was never meant for children, but then why do you have Jim Henson puppets in it?
Right. I kind of think it was meant for children, but I think there's also that metaphor that anybody who grew up and went and remembers being a selfish brat will go, oh,
I was kind of a twig.
Right. Oh, sure. I mean, who wasn't?
I mean, I don't know if we can answer it because, like, you guys said you grew up with it. I've showed it to kids. Or maybe it's one of those movies that is meant for, like, it's a family movie. Like, well, we want the young mom to like it. So, I don't know. Who should we get? David Bowie?
That's a good point.
According to the Wikipedia, David Bowie was intrigued and wanted to be attached to it early on. So,
well, it really is a great story because it's, like we said, it's coming of age, but I like it because it has all of the elements of a great fantasy. This is like the epitome. This movie is like the epitome of our podcast, I think. Because it's got, you know, like almost that line from Princess Bride where it's got adventure, it's got fights, it's got the love story, it's got the quest, getting sidetracked from the quest, you know, with the mm-hmm. junkyard.
Yeah.
She was a lady, right? Was that a woman playing her?
I believe so.
I thought so.
I mean, it was a puppeteer, so what really difference does it make? But yes, the character was a woman.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and building relationships along the way and coming into your own. And, you know, I still remember the scene when there's so many great lines for this movie.
But there's a lot. It was hard for me to both quote.
In the oubliette.
Beware, Fuzzer.
Just forget it.
Oh, please. I haven't said it for such a long time.
Oh, all right. But don't expect a big reaction.
No, of course not. For the path you will take will lead to certain destruction. Thank you very much.
Uh-oh. So that's an element that I think it's funny, but kids would get that, like, stay back. Children understand. And it's scary, but it's not like something where a little kid would run to their dad and say, you know, Aunt Sharon told me the dream fairy was going to fly into her house. And, oh, my God. I scared my niece one time. I made up this whole character, which I shouldn't talk about in the podcast because then somebody might steal my idea. But, I mean, do you guys think there are any really scary parts that would be ridiculously frightening for kids?
You know, I think it, I agree with your point that it is a great adventure movie. You really move from obstacle to obstacle in like a great kind of almost seamless way. Mm-hmm. And he even plants things, right? Like we hear about the Bog of Eternal Stench a bunch of times before we get there. We meet Hoggle, but he doesn't really join up until later on, you know? So I think it's a, you know, from like a Dungeons and Dragons perspective, it's a great D&D movie. You have the adventuring party, you have a dungeon, they're trying to get through it. I think the scariest part, I don't know, I would say it's probably that giant drill machine.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's pretty scary. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
Until you see the back of it, right?
Right. Yeah, then it becomes comedy, right?
Yeah, but, giant slicey things are kind of bad, right?
Yeah, but I don't know that it doesn't scare me in the way maybe the Dark Crystal would when I was a kid.
Right. Yeah, and I don't, I remember it. I remembered it as being scary, but then when I watched it, I thought, oh, isn't that so clever that the big thing that they're so afraid of, this Bog of Eternal Stench, the worst thing that happens to you, not that it's not bad, but the worst thing that happens to you is that you smell. It's not as if it, like, melts your skin off or, like, something horrible like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But to kids, when I was listening to it this time, I thought, well, the sounds are sort of like, well, dare I say it? Fart sounds.
And, right.
And kids
love that.
You know, find it hilarious. And I know because, you know, now I'm a first grade teacher. A month ago, I think I was a kindergarten teacher. But, yeah, I finally learned my kindergarten stuff, so they graduated me. But, yeah, like, I agree with you totally, Bonnie, that, I mean, it's really not that bad. But Hoggle thinks it's ridiculously bad, you know, and he doesn't even want to be kissed by her. And Jareth makes fun of him at one point and says, you know, what did she tell you? That you're her friend? And, you know, don't let her kiss you. I'll turn you into a prince.
And Hoggle, if she ever kisses you, I'll turn you into a prince.
You will?
Prince of the Land of Stench!
Yeah. What about, didn't you learn something about the hands when she's falling down the pit?
Yeah, there were 100 actors doing the hands.
And oh, she was really in this, actors?
Like, yeah, she was in this, like, tower rig thing, and they had to hold her there between takes, and so she was just, like, kind of hanging in this...
My God.
Yeah, we actually, that rig is in the Puppetry Museum in Atlanta, Georgia, that Bonnie and I have been to.
Ooh,
tell us
more.
Tell us about it.
So, and they, the guide told us this story that those hands...
Well, we should say, so there's the Puppetry Museum in Atlanta, and they had a Jim Henson exhibit there, which is the reason that we went to it, because the Puppetry Museum part of it is actually rather small, and it's puppetry from, like, all over the world.
Okay.
But this was just Jim Henson, so everything about Jim Henson. Sesame Street, Muppet Show, all of the movies.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it was really, really awesome, right. And I believe they've expanded that since we have been there.
I believe
actually.
So, yeah. I'm not
you mean the Jim Henson exhibit is still there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. I think they had gotten a bunch of pieces donated, and the story was they were going to throw that out, and the Puppet Museum was like, no, we want this,
right.
You know, rig of arms.
Uh-huh.
And that it was that they got a bunch of young women who were aspiring actresses to put their arms in there and be the arms, and they didn't pay them. They gave them each, like, 5 minutes to take pictures and meet David Bowie was kind of their payment.
Wow.
That's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my
so
God,
that was the that was how they got that all of the actors to be all of those hands in that scene where she falls down that hand well.
She chose down.
And currently at the Puppetry Museum, I'm looking it up right now, the Center for Puppetry Arts, they have a special labyrinth exhibit.
Oh, we should definitely get down
in the Atlanta area.
Yeah.
I want to go.
You should.
It was awesome. It was one of the coolest things, I think, that we experienced while we were in Atlanta. It was so fun. The guide was really good. We just learned so much. And then, so what was interesting is then they had this other puppetry area, which sadly nobody was in at all. So it's just us. And they had some Jim Henson stuff in there too. And they had told us that there was a life-size Skeksis from The Dark Crystal in that part. So we were like, well, we got to go see the Skeksis. So we go through the museum, and the whole time, like, the puppets are, like, moving on their own, and it's completely quiet, and we're the only people in there, and it was creeping us
creepy.
Out.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Super creepy. And we were, you know, like, but we were like, we want to be respectful, and we want to look at all of these different things.
Right.
And then as we were going through, we started going faster and faster and faster, like, let's just get to the Skeksis. So we see the Skeksis. Skeksis is awesome. So then we went and watched Dark Crystal again that night. And then at the very, very end of the exhibit, there's this human-sized praying mantis that's behind glass. And it had, like, a lever on it. So you started to, like, use the levers, and the levers are making the arms move. And it was kind of cool. We were like, okay, this is neat. And then a light comes up, and a sign, like, suddenly appears that says, are you controlling the puppet, or is the puppet controlling you? And we literally screamed and ran like a movie. We were like, annoying puppet.
Yeah, and the other thing that happened during that was, just to take the sidebar even further, is the light in the case went out, and it turned into a one-way mirror. So you were longer looking at the praying mantis. You were looking at yourself working the lever when this sign came up. It was super creepy.
Yeah.
But
that's pretty messed
stuff
up.
Was awesome.
Oh, so cool.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff about Labyrinth and Dark Crystal in that museum.
Yeah.
So I do this once in a while. I have to ask James and Bonnie, what were your favorite little bits or what were your favorite scenes? If somebody else hadn't ever seen Labyrinth and you wanted to show it to them, what would you say? Like, this is my favorite scene.
Oh, I actually said it while we were watching it, is that the scene where she discovers Ludo being harassed by the little goblin guys. And I was like, oh, it's Ludo. Like, I had forgotten Ludo
existed.
I was so delighted to see him back again. He's
That's
my
friend Ludo who talks to talk. Yeah.
You guys probably don't ever remember a show called The Young Ones. It was a British comedy.
No.
But there's a character on The Young Ones, Neil, who when we first saw Ludo, I mean, we were... You know, I was a grown-up when I first saw it, and I realized that he looked like Neil from The Young Ones. And Neil is this sort of sad British guy. He always talks like this. He was like, I'm not sure if it was deliberate, but I think he might have been the inspiration
For Ludo.
For Ludo.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah.
So I keep, like, thinking of Ludo saying in a British accent, you know, it smells bad. And have you guys seen the Shawshank Redemption?
Oh, sure.
Yes.
The first time I saw that movie, and I saw Brooks, the older guy, I thought, where have I seen this guy before? And about halfway through the movie, I realized, oh, my God, he looks exactly like Hoggle.
Wow. Is it Hoggle?
I have no idea. Well, no, Hoggle's a Muppet. No idea if he was the inspiration for Hoggle.
Okay.
And
okay.
I haven't found anything. Like, I even went looking on the internet to find out if, you know, I put that guy's name and Hoggle in the same sentence. And all I found was something on cheeseburger.com that says, you know, one of those totally looks like. Someone else had seen the resemblance. So.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, you should make a meme of that, right? Of them, like, side by side.
Yeah, you should. James, so what is your favorite part?
So my favorite part is I love the huge battle at the end. I was thinking about this when we were watching it, you know, when they're in the sort of, I guess, village area almost.
Right, the Goblin City at the center of the labyrinth.
Yeah, that is, it's so... First, it holds up. You know, it's definitely an argument for practical effects and puppetry, because it still holds up. It's still exciting. You can still see, like, when they're up, you know, when Ludo's up there in the tower, you can see the tops of houses for, you know, very far back.
Right.
It's a great painted background that they've made, and they've built a bunch of other stuff. And I also think, you know, it's probably the young boy inside of me, but it's still, like... even when we were watching it, it's exciting to watch, you know, and it's funny. Like, there's some great moments with Sir Didymus in that. There's some great moments with Ludo in that. So I think it's cool. And I think from a perspective of, like, feminism, Jennifer Connelly's character is pretty good at taking care of herself too. Like, she doesn't need them to protect her, you know?
So, interesting.
Yeah.
Now, I have to tell you, is that the scene? Oh, please don't be mad at me, James. Is that the part where I fell asleep, Chris?
Yeah, it is.
Now I have to explain.
It's long.
I think because it's so visual. So people have to remember that I can't see. So just as a blind person, it's like a talkie-talkie movie, except for that part.
Yeah, that probably just sounds like a wall of noise.
I think that I just sort of drifted a little bit.
And as far as the plot goes, that's sort of a black box where the party walks in on one side and she walks out on the other side alone saying, this is something I have to do by myself.
Yep, yeah,
like,
absolutely.
What happens in the city is there's a lot of great visuals and a lot of good sight gags.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really affect the plot much.
No, you would be fine without it. Absolutely. You would absolutely be fine without it. So.
But no, it's your favorite part, so we can't...
But I agree. It's because it is so visual, because I think my other favorite part is the M.C. Escher painting are suddenly in at one point.
At the end.
Yes,
the stairs, yeah. I remember that, and I remember every time, you know, as a sighted person seeing that, going... How are they doing that?
Right.
That is really freaky. And with the combined with the music, and, you know, we haven't said anything about the music yet, so this is a good opportunity to say.
Well, you didn't ask me what my favorite part was.
Oh, I'm sorry. What was your favorite part?
Well, actually, I was going to ask you first. What's your favorite part, Sharon?
I have so many. I was thinking maybe when she enters the maze, but I don't like the running scene where she's just... For me, it's like, okay, enough running! And plus, you're showing the same things over again. So it wasn't that one. I would have to say probably one of the scenes where she's with Jared. Either the beginning... No, not that, because she's too whiny. I guess the ending. I'm sorry, I didn't have this ready. I'm thinking of it.
It was your question. You should have been prepared for it.
I know. I thought maybe I wouldn't have to answer it because I was asking the question. When he says to her that he's changed the world for her, that he's reordered time, and he said, frankly, living up to your expectations.
I'm exhausted from living up to your expectations.
Yes, and it just tells you so much about the land and him and... and what's going on with her.
It completely twists your perception back around, because you thought he was an adversary to her. But then when he phrases it that way, you realize, he really is doing what she said.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been frightening. And
You wanted a scary bad guy. I've been scary for you.
Yes. I've been, this has been hard. All I really want to do is play with this baby and sing my songs and, turn him into a goblin. And
My favorite scene is actually the opposite end of the movie. It's when she arrives and she's figuring stuff out piece by piece, when she has, when she's completely out of her element.
Mm.
She gets the first couple clues.
When the fairy bites her.
When the fairy bites her. It's hey, this isn't going to be like I expected it to be. And when the worm talks to her. I love the worm.
The worm's great.
Hello.
Allo.
Hello.
Did you say hello?
To the castle.
Right. Never go that way, right?
If she'd have kept on going down that way, she'd have gone straight to that castle.
Right. So, what if she did? So then she encounters a bunch of stuff, and every single thing she encounters teaches her something new. But I kind of like that first, when she's getting the first couple clues that I have to change the way I'm thinking. I have to change the way I see the world.
Well, doesn't Jareth tell her? You say, she says, that's unfair. And he says, you say that a lot. Mm-hmm. I do not think it means what you think it means.
Wrong movie.
Oh, I'm sorry. But it's very similar to that, isn't it?
It's kind of. I mean, that is her standby
go-to
phrase for, this isn't going the way I want it to go.
It's not fair.
You say that so often. I wonder what your basis for comparison is.
And I love whenever Jareth says anything. I just...
Or nothing.
Or nothing. And he
nothing,
just like...
Nothing, tra-la-la.
Oh, my God! I love that line.
Yes, well, that's one of the stock phrases that we have adopted into our vocabulary.
Yeah. Well, and it is. It's such a quotable film.
Right.
It is that... I do love when she's changing her thinking and... I do love, and again, this is another scene that you could probably not have and the plot would be fine, but guys, Dance Magic Dance.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We've been singing that all week. Oh, my God. You remind me of the babe. What babe? The babe.
So the David Bowie songs are great. I think we can all agree that the worst scene in the movie is the fiery Chili Down gang. Are we all in agreement on that one?
Which is a shame because those puppets are fascinating. They move so cool. They look so cool. They do really cool things when they're like taking out their eyeballs and they're coming out their mouth. Like that's actually, I remember that scene as being very scary when I was a young kid, those characters were very scary. And then when we were watching it this time, I was like, how I did this green screen is horrible.
It was really bad.
Like just horrible.
So
what
there's actually a
happening?
Bit of trivia in the Wikipedia page that Henson didn't like the way that scene came out because of the green screening. He thought the green screening was terrible, but he thought the puppetry was good enough to put it in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so, whether he was right or not, I don't know. I guess it depends on how old you are when you're watching the movie.
Yeah.
Oh, certainly. And it's fascinating, too, to think about, how far we've come in cinema.
Right.
That I don't think that anyone would ever allow something that matched that mismatched that terribly to actually go out and be a movie that people paid for.
Yeah. They would either cut the scene or reshoot it,
Right. And it does match up later in the scene. So it's like horrible at one point and then you're like, okay, they are on the rocks.
Right.
It's okay.
Right. And when the head flaps up next to her when she's climbing up the wall, that brings it back to
that is great.
Back to the rest of the movie, kind of ties it back in.
Fun gag. Yeah, it is. That scene, and, I don't know, this may get some pushback from everybody, but the very opening scene where Jennifer Connelly comes out and talks to camera, and that for me is like, what is this girl doing? Like, even when, so when you are a little kid and you play pretend, you might be doing that.
Right.
But I...
She's too old.
Yeah, like that. And it's not... In the same way, it's not the same as when she has her teddy bear and she's mad about the teddy bear being gone, because that's like, okay, that was an object you've had, presumably, from the time you were a little kid that you are connected to.
Right.
This just felt like, I think this woman is homeless and crazy. And I hope everything is. You know what I mean?
So you, like, weren't invested in the character yet, is what you're saying.
I think that setting up the story is what the purpose
of
that
sure.
is. And so
right.
the other thing that I thought was interesting about that scene is that I think that that Jennifer Connelly looks very young. I did not, like, I would not have guessed that she was actually 15 mm-hmm. until they're like, we'll leave you home with the baby. And I was like, what? What's happening? This is like an 11-year-old
okay.
girl. So that
so
was
thought she was like 11 or 12.
That part worked for me because I thought she was much younger.
Mm.
Too young to be a babysitter.
I thought that she was until they told me that she was 15 and that was fine. But that's why her, like, playing dress up and running around, you know, in a park by herself reciting
yeah.
lines from a book, that didn't seem strange to me at all until I learned that she was 15. And then I was like, that does seem a little bit, like, she's just a little bit still in that whole, you know, in that whole play pretend phase of
right.
life that I wish none of us had.
If she's 15, is that someone who is too old to be playing dress up?
I think in the way that she is doing it, it seems a little bit out of place.
A little
but
weird.
Then
yeah.
the stepmother
yeah.
does mention that, which I thought was it really interesting.
Yeah.
And it's just one
yes.
line, but when she says, you should be out on a date with boys,
yes.
it's kind of like, oh.
We'd like you to. We'd like
right.
you to. And then she tells the husband later, you know, she treats me like a stepmother in an evil, doesn't she say that? She treats
oh,
me
yeah.
like
a stepmother.
Like
a
wicked
stepmother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stepmother.
Right.
Yeah.
yeah,
yeah. Because, and there's a lot of hints in the opening scenes where even with her father, he knocks on the door and she says, oh, he practically broke down the door.
Right. She's
yeah.
like, no, don't come talk to me. And when he doesn't, she's like, you didn't even try hard enough.
yeah. And can I tell you, I've seen this movie so many times and I took it one way, and Chris took it a completely different way. I thought she was, like, over-exaggerating. And Chris said, no, what she meant was that he wasn't trying hard enough to try to come in to see her.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure, even now, which way it was meant. But, you know, clearly she was living in her own little fantasy type of world. So, I mean, that's why it's very interesting later. Sarah, do you think she's going to be different the next day when she goes to school?
That's a really great question because, you know, she does change throughout the movie. Obviously, I don't think that she's going to be mean to Toby, like, ever again in his
yeah.
entire life. Like,
right.
now he
right.
gets whatever he wants.
Right.
But, you know, but then all those characters come back, and so is
yeah.
that the movie trying to say that she's going to continue to embrace this kind of fantasy part of her lifestyle? Or does it, like, or I don't know. Yeah, it's a really interesting question.
Yeah.
I would love to think that she does. But again, as a 15-year-old, you know, I mean, I think we all know on this podcast that it might be a little hard to, you know, have this wonderful fantasy life, or, you know, if she actually did have this fantastical experience, how would she relate to the other teenagers who aren't into that as much?
Right, and after Jared, I mean, how could she go out with I mean, you know, really, you know, somebody that's just a normal guy, or might she start playing D&D with people? I just gave you a plug, Chris, for Woolsey.
Right, yeah, thanks.
So there you go.
Great way to be dudes.
Yeah.
You
I
know?
Mean, I think I said on a different
but
podcast.
But how many of them look like Jareth, really?
Well,
only James.
Well,
he's
and Chris.
The only one.
Right. Yes, but I moved the stars for no one.
I know, but
which brings us to the music.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right.
We did touch on it a little bit earlier.
We tried to, but then
yeah,
I stopped us. But I will get us back there again. We watched it with a grown man who had not seen it before, who is also into fantasy and gaming. A magic dance came on, and he
yeah.
said, I didn't know this was a musical, and it hadn't occurred to me that it was. But it is, kind of.
It kind
yeah.
of is.
Yes, yeah, sort of. Certainly not in a traditional sense where the
yeah.
music is supposed to move the plot along.
Uh-huh.
It seems like there's only like three songs in it, right? David Bowie has two, and then the weird Chili Gang had.
It has three if you count the intro song, which is underground.
And the one in the dance number. The one where they're at the mask.
But yeah, it seemed to me like I wouldn't necessarily characterize this as a musical so much as it is a fantasy movie, and because David Bowie is in it, there are all the songs that he sings. And we all just accept this because it's David Bowie.
He's singing when they're in the Escher house.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that's another actual song. So I'm looking at the soundtrack listing. And so so David Bowie wrote all of the songs that have lyrics in them, even Magic Dance, which he doesn't sing in. I'm sorry, even Chili Down, which he doesn't sing in.
Oh, right. Interesting.
The rest of the incidental music was done by Trevor Jones.
Which I also liked.
Which was also very good. It does kind of date the movie because it's like exactly what you were saying about the Tangerine Dream soundtrack to Legend, Sharon. It's got kind of a synthy sound and it kind of puts it solidly in the 80s, but it's also pretty good.
Yeah.
And
you
memorable.
Know what we haven't talked about at all?
Huh.
Were the Knockers.
Right.
I wanted to say I liked the Knockers a lot.
Oh, yeah, the Knockers are great. And that was the part that actually really made me feel like there was a lot of D&D inspiration. And I don't know that that's true.
Oh, yeah.
Just
absolutely.
The fact that, like, sometimes there are battles and sometimes there are riddles or puzzles that you have to figure out.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We should do a whole D&D podcast with James and Bonnie and try to draw her into our creepy world.
You guys, we could do it on the round table. We could come on and talk about the film from a D&D perspective.
That'd be great.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So the song Underground, I remember hearing before the movie came out, and I remember thinking it was really cool. But listening to it as a 40-something-year-old man, those lyrics are not really good.
it's okay for an opening. I mean, I think you're also focusing on, okay, who is the main character? Okay, what is she doing? Like, and you're reading credits,
yeah,
so it doesn't
life
have
can't
to be
easy. It's not always swell.
Chris,
whoa!
No one says swell anymore.
Even today, I would say a fair amount of our pop music, if you got into the lyrics of
there's that,
you know.
But during the opening credits, there's a computer animated owl, which you look at it today and you say that looks like crap. But that was one of the first feature film attempts to put a computer animated animal in it.
Okay, so not when he changed from the owl into Jared.
No, I'm not talking about that.
That you liked, okay.
So the person who did the music on this also did Dark Crystal.
Yep. Yeah.
And also did Excalibur, which we've already talked about.
Fascinating. One of my favorites and not Chris's
favorite.
Not
one of mine.
another movie with great, great one-liners. But
what I also think is interesting is that I kind of lump in Labyrinth and Dark Crystal together in my brain, but also Neverending Story, which is, it, I guess, because it's another, like, this is clearly a kid's movie, but it's a dark kids movie, and that I don't think has any kind of relation, but obviously Dark Crystal does.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm probably going to catch hell, but I have to confess, I've never actually seen The Dark Crystal.
What?
Well, we're going to have to come back on and watch The Dark Crystal.
It's going to happen.
I will say, it's interesting, because The Dark Crystal is the predecessor, in Jim Henson's fantasy film career before this. The thing that is interesting is Dark Crystal, no people,
Right.
They're humanoid puppets.
Yeah, humanoid puppets, but like the Skeksis, there are six people per one Skeksi, there's some very, very intensive work that goes into that. I would say that the script definitely leaves something to be desired in that one, more so than in this movie.
Oh, that's a really good point. Yeah, I would say, when I was saying it was amazing, I was being pretty sarcastic. I have a lot of memories about it, and I would love to watch it again, but I do remember after we saw the real-life model Skeksi in the museum, and then we were watching it that night, and we were like, this is not quite living up to our expectations, okay. But I definitely feel like it is worth watching if you love Jim Henson, because the puppetry really is fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. And if you love Labyrinth the way you do, Chris, I feel like you'll get a lot more out of it, too.
Right. Yeah, I could not imagine why this failed so badly at the box office, and it did. I mean, look at the box office numbers on Wikipedia. It had a $25 million budget, and it made about half that back.
Oh, no.
Just over half that at the box office.
I did not realize that.
Yeah, it was a major failure.
Wow. Huh.
That is, I don't understand it.
Henson was very disappointed with its reception because he felt very strongly about
with Yuffie.
Yeah, but I mean, he put a lot of work into it, but he also felt very strongly about the product that he made here.
I think it's good.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't understand why. I mean, maybe it was just that. What other fantasy movies were out then? Was it just that people weren't ready for them yet?
So Lady Hawk was 85, and that also was a failure at the box office. So I guess fantasy was just not selling.
Didn't I say that? I said maybe fantasy wasn't
so, yeah, you said then. Ferris Bueller, and I made me think of Lady Hawk, so I had to run to look that up.
Sure. Although Big Trouble in Little China, also 1986. Just throwing it out there. So.
You know, also, though, but let's – I mean, another connection to D&D, there were a lot of if I have my years correct, and I may have my years correct, D&D was getting bad press, wasn't it? In the middle 80s, like you didn't want to admit – you did not want to say, I mean, you guys were little, but we were already, I was going into college. I was like maybe 17 in 86.
Sure.
So I remember that if you play D&D, you did not talk about playing D&D because adults would look at you funny like, oh, do you have mental problems? Because there were articles about it saying like that kids were, you know, would commit suicide if their characters died. And the thing is that it's just a game, you know? It's not a lifestyle. It's maybe you could argue that it is, but I mean
it's James's lifestyle.
it's a little bit sort of ours too. I mean, we definitely consider ourselves gamers, and I know we're getting a little off track, but I'm just it does relate to the movie because we have said that there are definitely strong connections to liking fantasy and playing fantasy games and D&D. It's very D&D-esque, if you will. And maybe that's why. Chris, what do you think?
I'm considering it, and I'm disagreeing with you.
Oh, well, you definitely disagree with me.
I think fantasy was sort of on this cusp of not really coming into its own theatrically yet because we were too sophisticated for the special effects that we'd had, and CGI was not a thing yet.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that these first movies broke the ground, but they weren't quite it.
A great cult following, you know, a cult following built up shortly after it left theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Henson didn't know about its following before he died, so he felt like he had reached an audience, even though it wasn't the one that was spending money on it.
Think about who likes it. When we go to gaming conventions, all the gamers know Labyrinth.
Sure.
So, and now it's okay to admit, hey, I'm a gamer, and yes, I play D&D, but still, even at work, I don't really admit that I play D&D to my coworkers, or I'm hesitant, let's put it that way, because people do kind of look at you a little strangely, like, but you're an older, sophisticated, well-dressed woman. Why would you know? How do you like that I added well-dressed?
That's good.
You know, because I think the image, like even on the spoof cartoons, who did one on World of Warcraft and
South Park,
and you know, you think of kind of the heavier set guy in mom's basement eating pizza and popcorn, and you know, possibly not showering for a while, but you know, but that's not your typical gamer.
Sure.
I'm open to other theories, but I'll consider that one.
So I'm just throwing that out there, Chris.
Yeah.
So
I think it's probably a combination of the satanic panic
right.
and
the lack of special effects not catching up with people's imaginations yet at that point, and probably the fact that, you know, it might have been that parents were confused about, like, who is this for? Because we've got puppets, but then we've also got David Bowie, so, you know, and so maybe it was
and
that.
The breakfast and sausage.
You know, yeah, exactly. And and I think it has done very well since then. I think tons and tons of people have seen it. When you go to conventions, you see service dogs cosplaying as Sir Dimas.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, I think...
I didn't even think we could do that with Ava. That's a great idea.
It's brilliant, just, yeah.
I love that. You just, you know, yeah.
So yeah, so maybe it was a combination of all of those things, you know.
I think you're right, James. I think you hit upon it. Are we ready to rate, Chris?
Yes, we are. Sharon, obviously, since you're busting your britches,
I am David Bowieing out because. okay, you're gonna be surprised.
Sharon, on a scale of 1 to 5
gold pieces, yes.
How do you rate Labyrinth?
I'm going to give it exactly 4 gold pieces.
Would you like to rationalize that?
I don't think I need to. I think...
Whoa.
I think it's everything I've said thus far. David Bowie was phenomenal. The only reason why I'm not giving it 5 is because I didn't like the song, the one song with the cat from Red Dwarf. And
Danny John Jules singing Chilly Down.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Thank you. And just, you know, a couple things that I
you can say it. You fell asleep during my favorite part. I understand.
I don't want to say it twice. For me, there were just a couple parts. You know, the owl. I think that this movie would be really, really great if they could redo it. I don't know who they could get to play Jareth.
I hope they never redo it. And we may have difficulty between us this evening for you saying that.
I just think that the parts that were messed up, they could fix. But, you know, you could be right. I'm not gonna jump up and down and say that I have to have this movie remade because I don't like the remake of Willy Wonka. I think that Johnny Depp was an interesting idea, but I liked the original. So anyway, okay. So I give it 4.
Bonnie, on a scale of 1 to 5 gold pieces, how do you rate Labyrinth?
See, that's tough because I thought this was going to be out of 10 gold pieces, and so I was going to give it a 7. But if we're doing 1 to 5, I think I have to give it a 3. Just because, you know, there were some parts that I thought were really... that were weaker about the story. And I feel like, I think that the storyline about David Bowie, with Jareth and Sarah, her wanting him to be in love with her and this weird sexual tension they had, I feel like I wish that they had actually delved into that more and had it maybe not so much a children's story, because I think that that is really interesting. And as a little girl who had loved fantasy and had those kind of like dreams about, you know, this mysterious magical person and, you know, being in love with me, like, it would be kind of fascinating to see that play out with a young girl and an actual grown man and what they could do with that. And I think they hinted at it, but they didn't go there, so it just made it sort of confusing. So that's why I give it a 3, but still... Okay.
You want to
love
split your fraction and give it 3.5 to make it 7 reduced?
Yes, let's do that.
we'll allow fractions. How's that?
So Bonnie, you would have wanted to see more of a romance between them. Am I understanding that correctly?
Either that or to take those little, the couple of hints that they had about it out. And make it just purely children's movie. I feel like it exists in this weird realm in between.
Okay. I get what you're saying.
Works.
Okay.
Okay.
So, James, to you and down to Chris.
So, I am going to go for the 3 gold pieces and 5 silver option as well. And my reasoning, and I do know that you guys rate 1 through 5, but my reasoning is because, I really like the film. And I think a lot of it holds up very well. I think that there are so many great points that are very subtle, and they sort of respect their audience, their child audience. So aside from the few quirks we've already mentioned, I really think that beginning scene about her needing to grow up is so heavy-handed.
Sort of on the nose.
Yeah, it's so on the nose and so heavy-handed that I think tonally it's also a problem for me. And I really just don't like that she comes out and speaks directly to the camera. Really, really messes
so
with me.
Weird.
And I do think that there are a few sort of pacing issues. You really do feel the urgency at one point, and then it'll be like, all right, now we're going to take a break for 10 minutes and watch this scene where we sing, so I think that some of the pacing, could have been, could be solved and updated. So I too am going to give it a 3.5.
So James, I am wondering, so how would you feel of a remake of Labyrinth?
If it as was long as they got Kid Rock, I'm good,
Okay.
I think the key would be, one, you'd have to have all of the Henson people on board, the Henson company on board. And two would be, you would have to find the right person, and I am not sure who that is. Maybe it's the pop star Mika? Is like a David Bowie.
He's British, and yeah, I know, Chris. I'm sorry, but I would see it. But I'm not sure that you're ever gonna this film. Even with the 3.5 rating, I do feel like this film is lightning in a bottle in the sense that you're not going to be able to get the same thing. And Bowie is so
one of a kind.
Yeah, he's so one of a kind. It would be. I feel like
there's no way, even if you did it and it was a great film, there's no way that people would be able to ever acknowledge that out of respect for him, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
Nerds,
loved. And, especially now that he so tragically passed away so early in life, that is really, I just don't think that anybody would do it from that standpoint.
No, it's too soon. It's definitely too soon. Yeah.
But also, if David Bowie were still alive, I feel like you could do a remake with David Bowie.
David Bowie.
He was still so sexy, at over 60,
There you have it.
But Chris, I don't think you rated the movie yet.
You didn't ask.
Well, please tell us. We are waiting with bated breath.
Well, you should brush your teeth.
Oh, my God.
I would give this... I consider Labyrinth a solid 4. And it's for much of the same reasons that you guys said, but I still could watch this over and over again. And even though there are those sort of slow moments where it's like, as you said, the pacing was going, was building, and suddenly there's a sort of a departure that doesn't have much to do with anything. And the thing that mainly takes away from this movie is...
The chili down song
and...
Sorry.
No, that's fine. And there's a couple of the songs that don't work. Like the Underground song doesn't really do anything for me anymore. I mean, I used to like it, but it doesn't really help me anymore. And also I have to, knock it down a little bit for the internal confusion it inspires in me every time I see it.
And just one other thing I really need to mention real fast. Is this the way every goblin is made? Because that takes a long... This is like a huge process to create a new dumb goblin for the Goblin King to have command over.
It's possible. This was based on... Not based on, but the idea of the Goblin King stealing children is from an old Maurice Sendak story.
Oh, gotcha.
Now we all have to go and look that up.
Yeah, I mean, just the basic idea that the Goblin King stole a child is what's in that. So.
Well, that's a very fey concept that really goes back to appeasing the fey and not going out stealing. I mean, that's a very old concept. I guess every culture, I was going to say European, but because I was thinking Irish folklore, and there are fey creatures in almost every culture.
Mm-hmm. So I found the book title.
Very good.
Outside Over There, a 9-year-old girl's baby sister is stolen by the goblins. That's where the similarity ends, but the film says, you know, the film credits say Jim Henson acknowledges his debt to the works of Maurice Sendak.
And you know what? That might explain Bonnie's feeling that in the beginning the girl is like 9 or 9-10 around that age. And maybe just the Hollywoodization of it makes her...
makes her have to be older.
Makes her have to be older. And also for the ballroom scene, if you're going to put a ball in where they're dancing, it would just be ridiculous if it was a 9-year-old.
Sure.
So it has to be somebody sort of on that cusp of, you know, like, most of the time, what are you, 16 when you do your coming out party? So she's like almost 16, and of course now, I think that, you know, it's definitely now more 18 you think of somebody as, because of laws and...
And decency.
I thought I was grown up at 26, and now I realize all the things that I didn't know when I was 26.
We were just saying that the other day. We were saying, so I'm about to turn 32, and I was saying, like, oh, when you're 22, you're such an idiot. And James was like, but yeah, when we're 42, don't you think we're going to say, oh, when we were 32, we were such idiots?
Yeah, we probably will.
No, when I was 32, I was awesome.
So, Chris, do you have any idea what movie we're doing next?
Yes, our next movie is going to be what's out in theaters right now. It will be Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
Okay, is it your pick?
It is my pick.
Ah, okay.
Are you going to do something about it?
Not at all. I mean, okay. It's your pick. But we should invite Bonnie and James back when we do Dark Crystal.
Ooh, absolutely. We'd love to do that. Yeah,
that'd be so great. Yeah, definitely. And maybe even the never-ending story?
Yeah.
So there are two invitations. So
there you go.
So, James, we should probably say, if people want to hear your podcast, can you tell the folks what your podcast is called and where to find it?
Yes. So I have a podcast on the Tome Show Network where I discuss D&D news with great people such as one Christopher Dudley. You can actually hear an interview with Bonnie about her first game of Dungeons & Dragons on there. The podcast is called...
That was good to hear.
Yeah. The podcast is called The Roundtable. I have another podcast called Have Spellbook Will Travel that is a scripted comedic radio play about an adventuring party. It's based on our D&D games, but it's all scripted, so it's not an actual play podcast. And that's at havespellbook.com, and you can find links to everything I do over at worldbuilderblog.com, which is my blog where I talk about usually Dungeons & Dragons.
Let's hear from Bonnie. Do you have an internet presence that you would like people to know about?
Sure. Well, I have an Instagram account where I do a lot of baking and cooking called Amateur Hour Food, so you can check that out. But also, James's podcast, Have Spellbook Will Travel, it's really, really fantastic. A lot of our friends are involved in theater, so the acting is just really, really well done, and our friend Rudy Basso does a terrific job with the production.
That's awesome,
of it. Yeah. It's very funny, and I'm saying that because you can also find me there. I have a guest starring role in this latest arc.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So have fun watching fantasy movies.
And have fun storming the castle.
Thanks for staying with us to the end of the episode. If you enjoyed this show, please go to iTunes and or Stitcher and give us a good review. That'll let us know what you think and also help other people find the show. Dragon Reel would love to hear from our listeners. You can email us at dragonreelpodcast@gmail.com and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/dragonreel. And join us on Twitter at twitter.com/dragonreel. If you want to comment directly on any episode of Dragon Reel, go over to our website, dragonreel.com, and leave us a comment. You can also give your rating of the movie yourself on our scale of 1 to 5 gold pieces. You know, the best way to enjoy the episode is to watch the movie with us, so while you're at our website, click our Amazon links to get your copy of the movie. If you go to Amazon from our site, you can buy anything on Amazon, and they will give us a few copper pieces to keep our show going. Our music is by Maggie Sansone and is used with permission. You can find this music and much more at maggiesmusic.com. Please join us again next episode.